Will you please join me in a time of reflection and meditation or prayer? These words come to us from Adam Dyer, a Black Unitarian Universalist minister. This White House, made for a white man, is a symbol of his power and an aspiration for all white men. This White House was built with black hands. This White House, that is power through wealth and wealth with a body count, is full of ideas to serve a white world. This White House was built with black hands. This White House shelters myths in a white temple of empire where divinity and man's ego converge. This White House was built with black hands. This White House cannot be dismantled with the master's tool, because the master's most valuable tool built this White House. Today, as we consider Martin Luther King Jr. Day, we consider how far we have come, and yet still how far we have to go. We consider the ever-evolving nature of the work we are called to do in the world, work that our faith traditions of Unitarianism and Universalism have been attempting to do throughout history, work that we individually have tried to do in our own lives, only to find ourselves circling back again and again. And no wonder, this work is hard. It does not come easy. And our own lives are often so full and so full of noise that it can be hard to hear the song of something greater, a song of hope, a song of possibility, a song of grace. And yet we invite ourselves to listen, because we know that is what we are called to do, and that without listening, we do not hear. So I invite you in our time of silence to listen, to listen to that small, still voice in your heart, to listen to the depth of your being, to listen to the cries of need that exist out in the world and even within ourselves. The young woman sat on her seat on the bus, a seat reserved for white people. And of this moment in history, she said, "They came to me and stood over me, and one said, 'Aren't you going to get up?' I said, 'No, sir.' He shouted, 'Get up.' I started crying, but I felt even more defiant. I kept saying over and over in my high-pitched voice, 'It's my constitutional right to sit here as much as that lady. I paid my fare. It's my constitutional right.' One cop grabbed one of my hands and his partner grabbed the other, and they pulled me straight up out of my seat. My books went flying everywhere. They started dragging me backwards off the bus. One of them kicked me. I kept screaming over and over, 'It's my constitutional right.' It just killed me to leave that bus. I hated to give that white woman my seat when so many black people were standing." And then this young woman was, of course, taken to jail. Now, do you know who I'm speaking about? You shout out the name, anybody that... not Rosa Parks. Not Rosa Parks. Isn't that what's interesting? You would think this is the story of Rosa Parks, but it's not. It's actually the story of Claudette Colvin. When she was only 15 years old, Claudette refused to move to the back of the bus and give up her seat to a white person. Now, this was 9 months before Rosa Parks did the very same thing, beginning the famous 1955 bus boycott. Colvin, however, was the first to really challenge this law. So when asked why everyone thinks only of Rosa Parks, Colvin says, at the time, black organizations felt Parks would be a good icon because she was an adult. They didn't think teenagers would be reliable. Likewise, Parks's hair and skin texture was the kind that people associate with the middle class, said Colvin. Rosa Parks was an easier icon to swallow. I tell this story because I think it's easy to go into a discussion of the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and think we've heard it all before. We've heard the stories, and we are, of course, on board with racial justice, so it's a done deal. But during the past few years in this country, maybe the past week in this country, we recognize more than ever that we are in trouble if we assume that racial justice is a done deal. Michelle Alexander's landmark book, The New Jim Crow, woke us up to the current system of mass incarceration of people of color, which has essentially replaced the older systems of slavery. And of course, we see the incidents of police violence toward people of color, which is not a police problem, but a cultural problem, evidenced by the election of the current administration, who have emboldened white supremacists. The president's remarks this very week about countries that are not primarily populated by white people indicate that the work of Dr. King is far from done. Our work as Unitarian Universalists is far from done, too. Theologically speaking, we Unitarian Universalists come out of the best of the Judeo-Christian tradition, that we are to make ourselves right with God and live a life of morality and caring reflective of Jesus. That's where we come from. At Unitarianism and Universalism's best, they have been religions that have asked followers to do the deeply spiritual work of being accountable to other human beings. And we can't do that if we are not evolving with the changing times. Dr. King summed up this theological imperative when he said, "Life's most persistent and urgent question is, what are you doing for others?" Now, our seven principles were an attempt in the 1980s to answer King's question, to be reflective of our theological roots and articulate our concerns in ways that could be acted upon in those times. And those principles, as stated, have been very useful over the past years, though not without their critics. You know, I've been leading classes for newcomers to Unitarian Universalism since I was an intern. Before that, actually, even as a layperson. And over the past few years, I've noticed that more and more people find Unitarian Universalism for the first time question the rather dry language of the principles. They're inclined to note that the word love does not appear in them. And you know, I was thinking in today's world, there are online discussion groups for just about any identity a person might have. There are TED Talks on any subject. And the need that was born out of 1950s for UU communities to be primarily lecture halls, I think we've moved away from that. And our principles can seem less inspirational or spiritual in their language than many people are looking for today. And so I think it's been about 30 years since these principles were articulated. We're in a place where we are seriously considering the evolution of them. And so what of this eighth principle, the one we are choosing to talk about as we celebrate Martin Luther King Jr. Day? This principle reads, "We, the member congregations of the Unitarian Universalist Association, covenant to affirm and promote journeying toward spiritual wholeness by working to build a diverse, multicultural, beloved community by our actions that accountably dismantle racism and other oppressions in ourselves and our institutions. So at this past summer's Unitarian Universalist General Assembly, that's our big gathering that we have annually, a vote was taken in favor of further exploring this eighth principle. Perhaps it's fitting we're talking about the number eight. In Chinese culture, people with the lucky number eight have strong intuition and insight, giving them the potential to explore things undiscovered. Perhaps we could be those people. So why now? Well, obviously the current state of racial concerns in our country is part of the reasoning. But this eighth principle is more a call for us to prioritize this issue within this community. Recently, the Unitarian Universalist Association, kind of our umbrella organization, has gone through a crisis over the inclusivity of its hiring practices. And likewise, the progress made since the UUA's 1997 commitment to being an anti-racist organization, that has declined in funding and support since the early 2000s. So the eighth principle asks of us to take strong leadership to reverse these trends. Now, the immediate assumption of many of us, and I think I'll include myself in that, is to say, well, if we make a principle about racial justice, we have to make one about this issue or that issue, women's rights or LGBTQ concerns. And certainly, Black Lives of UU, who drafted this eighth principle, are well aware of this concern. And in answer, they say, in the United States, racism stands out. The two worst crises of the UUA, late 1960s and now, have both been related to race. Racism in the U.S. stems from chattel slavery, where people were uniquely, legally treated as property that could be inherited for something, their skin color, they had no control over. The UUA has done well with women becoming ministers and leaders. In fact, the seven principles came out of the women's movement within Unitarian Universalism. And the LGBTQ community is well represented as members, ministers, RE staff, and other leadership in individual congregations and the UUA. We've also made good progress with those who are differently abled. The UUA, the U.S., and the world also have a lot of problems deeply based in economic class oppression, as Martin Luther King realized, in addition to militarism and materialism. And this principle includes that, but is not highlighting it. Words from the Black Lives of UU. And then they go on to say, our existing seven principles imply this eighth principle, but do not explicitly hold us accountable for addressing these oppressions directly, especially at the systemic level. So in other words, Black Lives of UU are asking us to no longer live by our assumptions that the implied call for racial justice found in our principles is enough. We UUs have a saying, a revelation is not sealed, meaning we are continuing to discover wisdom and truth. Our principles have never been, nor will they ever be, the end-all and be-all of who and what we are. Oh, this fact was never made more clear to me than a few years ago when my friend and colleague, Reverend Tara Little, began her time as minister at Troop, UU Church in Pasadena. There's Tara up there. Troop began in 1886 as a specifically universalist church. A Troop's a large Gothic building, vaulted ceiling, stone walls, stained glass windows. And Reverend Tara was given a large key ring with which she proceeded to explore the whole building, unlocking doors to rooms that hadn't been seen in decades. She found all kinds of treasures, clues to Troop's past, baptismal font, amongst other things. And a particular interest was a rolled-up banner marked 1899 on the back. And when she unrolled this banner, she found this statement of Universalist principle. So that's the actual banner she found. And universal fatherhood of God, the spiritual authority and leadership of his son, Jesus Christ, the trustworthiness of the Bible as containing a revelation, from God. The certainty of just retribution for sin and the final harmony of all souls with God. So we can see in this beautifully preserved historical item where the conversation with the universalist side of our faith tradition was 119 years ago. Would this statement of principles work for most of us today? I think the answer is obvious. So let's look at some other snapshots of our ever-evolving principles. On the Unitarian side, this is back in 1887, the Western Unitarian Conference, a declaration of principles included the following. We believe that to love the good and to live the good is the supreme thing in religion. We hold reason and conscience to be final authorities in matters of religious belief. We honor the Bible and all inspiring scripture, old and new. We revere Jesus and all holy souls that have taught men truth and righteousness and love as prophets of religion. We believe in the growing nobility of man. We trust the unfolding universe as beautiful, beneficent, and unchanging order. To know this order is truth. And we believe that good and evil invariably carry their own recompense, no good thing being failure and no evil thing success, that heaven and hell are states of being. We believe that we ought to join hands and work to make the good things better and the worst good, counting nothing good for self that is not good for all. So lots of great ideas here, right? And certainly we can see the evolution from some of these ideas to our principles today. But again, I don't think these probably work for us as stated. They're not as inclusive in their choice of language and ideas as we would demand today. So in 1961, the Unitarians and the Universalists, who had sort of been in this weird courtship for about 60, 70 years, realized they finally, they had more in common than they had different, and they merged, creating the Unitarian Universalist Association. And this statement at this time, 1961, read, "We, the members of the UUA, dedicated to the principles of a free faith, unite in seeking to strengthen one another in a free and disciplined search for truth as the foundation of our religious fellowship. To cherish and spread the universal truths taught by the great prophets and teachers of humanity in every age and tradition, and memorially summarized in the Judeo-Christian heritage as love to God and love to man." We've always been wordy, haven't we? "To affirm, defend, and promote the supreme worth of every human personality, the dignity of man, and the use of the democratic method in human relationships. To implement our vision of one world by striving for a world community founded on ideals of brotherhood, justice, and peace. To serve the needs of member churches and fellowships, to organize new churches and fellowships, and to extend and strengthen liberal religion. And then finally, to encourage cooperation with men of goodwill in every land." So again, we're getting to where we are now, but there's a lot of things still wrong with that. We certainly have improved our use of gender language. These are just a few snapshots of our principles and statements of faith at various points in our history. And there's much more to explore here. This is literally just a snapshot of this long evolution. And the important thing to note is that the UU principles were designed to be dynamic, not a fixed creed. As Dr. King said, "One of the great liabilities of history is that all too many people fail to remain awake through great periods of social change. Today, our very survival depends on our ability to stay awake, to adjust to new ideas, to remain vigilant, and to face the challenge of change." King's words remind us that when we get to a new level of understanding and clarity, the evolutionary nature of our unique faith, and we are unique in this ability because we can reflect that new revealed truth. This happened when environmental awareness reached a critical mass and got added as a seventh principle, although the language of interdependent web of all existence also has multicultural relationship implications. And we may be approaching a a similar critical mass level of awareness with the systemic nature of racism and other oppressions. And this is one of the reasons for the proposed eighth principle. Now, the people who drafted those old versions of our principles, after much deliberation and angst, likely felt they had finally gotten it right. I'm sure those universalists in 1899 never thought that banner would be rolled up and locked away in a room somewhere. But what we think of as a given is often the product of what has come before, and we humans don't always remember that history very well, as we see with Claudette Colvin and Rosa Parks. But when we take time to get past our assumptions, we can often find new truths. And I know we UUs, we like to be precise people, and we can get caught up in wordsmithing because we know that words are important. Yet sometimes I think we can get caught up in minutia. And, you know, I'll be the first to admit that happens to me. It happens to me in my own life. It happens to me here at UUCF. I get my feelings hurt, or I struggle with someone else's hurt feelings. And the details of that situation can be all I start to think about. It takes a hit on my internal reset button to reorient myself from the weeds to the stars so that I can move away from what's closing in on me and consider the greater space that surrounds us, from the weeds to the stars. Because it is the bigger picture we are constantly being called to, both in our individual lives and our life as a faith community. Goodness knows we have enough distractions, both shallow and substantive, from the everyday noise of our lives to real struggles of loss and relationships and practical concerns. But if we begin to assume that these things represent the fullness of our lives, we become lost. We have to move from the weeds to the stars, for from the stars we can see the whole picture. And to my mind, something like the eighth principle invites us to that bigger picture, to journey more deeply into this changing world of ours, to not assume that the issue of racial justice has been taken care of here at home, but to recognize that even with all our good intentions, we still have work to do. Martin Luther King Jr. was a great one for calling out our assumptions. "Never forget that what Hitler did in Germany was legal," he said. When machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered. Fortunately, we still have time before we are facing that which cannot be conquered, though our time, I don't know, likely in shorter and shorter supply. But there have been people who have paved the way to where we are today, and all those people in the past who took the time to articulate their statements of principles so they could do the good work needed in the world in their time. And people like Martin Luther King Jr., who spoke so eloquently of the intersection of rationalism, faith, and ethics, and a teenage girl on a bus by the name of Claudette Colvin, a name we should not forget, for her actions provided an important obstacle to the curtailing of freedom, an obstacle that gives us just a few more seconds on the calendar of the stars to do this work. A few more seconds so that we can take a breath and jump, not into the depth of the waters of night, but up into the starlight, not the light of luck, but the light of hope in a number. The hope of eight.